It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin has seen a number of major tornadoes this season, with the latest being a Category EF3 hitting the Fox Valley region in Menasha, Fox Crossing, Appleton, and Neenah. Workers and volunteers have been clearing debris and operating temporary shelters. Yesterday, local officials said these communities are moving into the long-term recovery phase. In just a few minutes, we'll check in with the village of Fox Crossing. First, the long-term work of rebuilding is ongoing in the town of Ringle. Another EF3 tornado damaged at least 75 homes in the Marathon County community back in April. Here to talk about where his community stands months later, we have Ringle Town Chair Al Christensen. Al, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Good morning.
We're a few months into your recovery after that tornado. How are things going there with rebuilding?
It's going pretty good. We have FEMA working here, and they're just about getting close to closing up their shop here and moving on. The rebuilding process has already started, and there's a few homes that are still standing that will probably have to come down yet.
Do you expect the town to feel the same once the reconstruction is over as it was before the tornado?
It'll take time. We'll get back there. There's a lot of trees missing, but it'll get there.
You're going to get there. Now, for homes that have been rebuilt yet, there's some still standing that will need to come down. Are there obstacles holding back the work that needs to be done, or is it just kind of prioritizing one over another right now?
I got to assume that people must be working with insurance companies and stuff to settle on whatever they're going to do, I guess.
Now, on the line with us, we have somebody from the village of Fox Crossing. They're just a week out from the tornado. What kind of lessons do you have from your own experience in Ringle that you would share with somebody just really starting this rebuilding process?
Oh, it's hard to give advice, but it's just so overwhelming that you just don't know where to go sometimes. But and it seems to work out. Everything will come together. You get so many volunteers and it'll come together, but it takes time.
And yeah, we talk, of course, a lot about the buildings and infrastructure. How about the people? How have you seen people pull together there in Ringle to get through this?
Oh, it's really been great. They're just the volunteers that have been helping out, people working together, you know, getting cleaned up. We've had a lot of major companies come in with equipment to help clean the brush and debris.
Al, thanks so much for bringing us up to date, and best wishes for the recovery as it goes on.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the call.
That's Al Christensen, chairman for the town of Ringle in Marathon County, hit by a tornado earlier this year. Been talking about recovery efforts and cleanup there. Now we turn to the ongoing effort in Fox Valley communities hit hard by last week's EF3 tornado. Here's Menasha Mayor Austin Hammond speaking on PBS Wisconsin's Here and Now.
It's really been truly incredible to see people come together in this really difficult moment. But it's incredibly sad how much damage has happened due to the storm.
Here now to talk about how his community is doing and where recovery efforts stand, we have Jeffrey Sturgill, village manager for Fox Crossing in Winnebago County. Jeffrey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Rob. I appreciate you having me on.
Jeffrey, I was up in Appleton this weekend for Mile of Music. I stayed away from the wreckage zone following local orders, but you could see some of it from major roads. Can you paint it? There's some serious destruction there. Can you paint us a picture of the part of Fox Crossing that saw that tornado come through?
Oh, yes, Rob. Yeah. Primarily, the tornado hit our east side. And when I say east side of Fox Crossing, our village is divided by the Fox River and Little Lake Butamore. So we have a west side and east side. Primarily, the damage was on the east side. So for anybody who's familiar with the area, it would be on the west, kind of the west border, if you generally want to say it, the west border would be Strobe Island and Fox Run area, and then running across, bordered by the Fox River on the north, 9th Street on the south, and then over to approximately Highway 47. So it's a rough rectangle there. That's the area that got hit in Fox Crossing. And then, of course, south of there, Menasha, and then even further south of there, Neenah and then the town of Neenah.
And how many people's houses and businesses were hit by the tornado there in Fox Crossing?
Yeah, it was significant. It would be premature to give out our damage assessment numbers right now. Winnebago County is working with us, and we're still developing those numbers. We have estimates, but we're hoping to get them verified. But it was significant. Our Palisades area, just tremendous amounts of damage, down trees everywhere. We do have homes that were basically crushed. We have a lot of homes with major damage and many homes with minor damage. But the vegetative debris is simply immense. So it is going to take us time to get through. We have several contractors that we've hired. We have our own crews out there working on the debris. But it really is substantial.
One thing people might not think of right away, yes, of course, the buildings and the trees down. Concerns with water there. The village just lifted its boil order a few days ago. What was the damage there to the drinking water system, and what did it take to get out of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, that's actually what I spent the initial first few days really, really focusing on. And thank you for bringing that up. We have two water systems, one on the west side and one on the east side. Our west side system did sustain some damage, but we were able, relatively minor when you compare it to what happened on the east side. We kept the west side, that stayed up and running. Basically, within a day, we had that fully up to normal operation. It was the east side. On the east side, we produce 50% of our water sales, we produce from wells, and then 50% we purchase from the city of Menasha, or Menasha Utilities, I should say. And what happened with the storm, it nailed our water plants and knocked our wells out, the power out, and it knocked out our backup generators. So we had no wells producing water. And then on the south side, the storm hit the Menasha Utility Treatment Plant and knocked that out. So Menasha quickly shut that valve off to maintain pressure. And then all the damage on Valley Road, the buildings that were struck with all our big warehouses, our fire station, it ruptured all the fire lines and drained our system. So we literally had to shut down our east side system. And then over the period of, 3 to 4 days, we were able to get that back online. And then fortunately, on this past Saturday, we were able to lift the boil alert. So now our east side system is fully operational. It's back up. The utility crews were amazing, Rob. I got to tell you, these guys just were working nonstop. And I got to give all the credit in the world to these guys for getting our water system back up and running.
Now, you mentioned Fire Station 41, I think it was, in Fox Crossing, was destroyed in the midst of an emergency. How did your team there try to deal with all the problems going on when they lost their home base and I'm assuming a lot of their gear?
Yeah. Actually, thank goodness we did have a couple of our firefighters. They literally were responding in the middle of the storm. They were heading out to the bay to actually hop on because calls, of course, started coming in. And all of a sudden, everything started rumbling and shaking and the roof started collapsing in. So they were retreating out of the bay. A couple of the firefighters were struck with some debris, just minor injuries, but thank goodness. But they ultimately ended up crawling out of the rubble and let us know that the station was destroyed. And so it really threw a wrench for some of our emergency response. But I mean, the outpouring of support from our neighboring communities, I mean, we had, so many fire trucks responding from through our mutual aid agreements, responding from the neighboring communities. I mean, we had more fire trucks circling Fire Station 40 and the municipal complex than I've ever seen before. So the outpouring of support of emergency support was just phenomenal.
Is that something that you and your neighboring communities are kind of rehearsing? Like, hey, if one of us loses a fire station, the ones next door are ready to rock?
Oh, absolutely. We have the mutual aid agreements already in place. But I mean, you know, even aside from that, it's just the camaraderie. The generosity of, for example, the city of Green Bay, you know, they're 30, 35 miles to the north of us. They have been phenomenal. They have been providing us some crews to aid us in debris removal. The village of Greenville has been phenomenal. O'Connell came down and helped us out for a short while. I mean, the outpouring of support is just amazing. We ran just this past Sunday. There was concern. We had been able to run a quick garbage run on Thursday through our damaged areas. However, I know the city of Menasha really needed to get it done as well. They hadn't done one yet. So this past Sunday, all of the local communities donated some garbage trucks to us, and we were able to have a special Sunday collection in which, you know, the city of Oshkosh, Green Bay, Kokona, I mean, all of these guys helped us out, and we were able to get an emergency garbage collection, you know, for all of the spoiling food, the diapers, the freezers that went down and everything rotting. So we were able to clear some of that unhealthy debris from the site on Sunday. And we would not have been able to do that without the generous support of our communities.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. Best to you and everybody in your community as you pick up the pieces here.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, Rob.
That's Jeffrey Sturgill, manager for the village of Fox Crossing. We've been talking about recovery efforts after the devastating tornado hit the Vaux Valley last week. We also heard from Town of Ringgold Chair Al Christensen about his community's recovery after a tornado in Marathon County this spring. Coming up, a bill in Congress would put an end to the practice of changing clocks in the spring and fall. Hear the pros and cons of daylight saving time all the time.
What you have here is a lot of different tensions that people are prioritizing depending on what their interests are.
A look at the history of the debate over the clock change and what goes on with our internal clocks. That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. A bill in Congress would put an end to the practice of changing clocks in the spring and fall to accommodate the switch from daylight saving to standard time. The legislation called the Sunshine Protection Act cleared the House and is now in the Senate, where its fate is uncertain. Wisconsin Senators Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson have not stated how they plan to vote. But elected officials in neighboring states have voiced opposition to permanent daylight saving time because of what they say are major drawbacks with later winter sunrises. In Wisconsin, the sun wouldn't rise until 8 in the morning or later in December and January. In just a bit, we'll hear from a traffic safety engineer and a sleep specialist about how changing the clock could affect daily life. Now, debates around daylight saving time have percolated for over a century. To put this in context, we reached out to Amanda Seligman, professor of history and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee. She spoke with Kate Archer-Kent.
Rewind here. Take us back to 1918 when the U.S. first instituted daylight saving time. What was the thought behind setting our clocks forward 1 hour, springing ahead for the summer months?
Yeah, well, 1918 is actually the middle of the story. But to pick up in the middle, that's really a war measure. They're trying to save energy by shifting when people are using the most electricity. And in doing so, that they're following the model of what's happened with the European powers during World War I. But I really do want to take you back to the 19th century, as all American historians do, if you'll let me do that.
Yes, please do. Take us way back.
Thank you. The reason we have daylight savings time in the first place has to do with railroads and the growth of railroads in the United States in the 19th century. Once you have these massive machines and these companies that are going all across the continent, it becomes important for Americans to be able to communicate with each other clearly about when something is going to happen. They want to make sure two really important things. One, that people get to the trains on time so that they can get on board and not miss their connections. And also, really importantly, they want to make sure that two trains aren't going in opposite directions on the same track at the same time, running into each other and causing a huge crash, a disaster. And so in the 1880s, the railroad companies get together and say, you know what, we're just going to make some time zones where everything in one of these four time zones is on the same time, regardless of what local time looks like, and coordinate our schedules so that we don't have those accidents.
There was also this thread of an idea that daylight saving time came from farmers and wanting them to have more sunlight to stay in the fields. How did that get connected to this issue?
Well, I think that might have been something that varied around the country because the farmers in Wisconsin did not like daylight saving. And they were one of the lobbies that opposed it in the 19-teens and the 1920s. And the reason for that is that by the 20th century, the major agricultural industry in Wisconsin is dairying. And you cannot change the cow's schedules.
No, you can't.
You cannot explain to the cow why they have to get up and be milked an hour earlier. They don't understand the truck is coming an hour earlier or an hour later. And so dairy farmers didn't like that disruption.
When Congress passes this Uniform Time Act of 1966, why didn't that federal law establishing a standard time of daylight saving time, why didn't that put this issue to rest?
Well, because when you establish time in that kind of uniform way across the country, even with separate time zones, you were trying to regulate a couple different things. You're trying to regulate people's sleep schedules. You're trying to regulate businesses, and you're trying to regulate recreation. And all three of those things have really competing needs. And so we have continued since the 1960s to debate at a high level or a low level which of those things is most important.
Can you take us, though, more to present day? And we see there's so much tension about whether we should spring forward and fall back. Can you talk about the competing forces that are at work around this issue?
Yeah, I think the competing forces are convenience, children, and businesses, recreation, and energy savings. There's like the five different things that people are arguing about when they're arguing about daylight savings. We all agree that it's a good idea to have uniform time so that we can talk to people who are far away for all the same reasons that that mattered in the 19th century. But in the 21st century, we have all these competing priorities and they have different needs. So when the people who are focused on kids are thinking about kids getting to school in the dark or kids' circadian rhythms, high school students needing to sleep later, etc., they are focusing on a different kind of need, a biological need, a social development need, a different kind of need than what businesses want in terms of when they should be open to, in order to maximize how much money they can get from their customers, which is at a different remove from the people who are running recreational facilities, both public ones like parks, as well as private ones like movie theaters and golf courses. So what you have here is a lot of different tensions that people are prioritizing depending on what their interests are. Nobody likes the time switch. That is inconvenient to everybody's body. But when they think about what makes the most sense to do on a permanent or ongoing basis, they have different things in their heads about what's the most important thing to prioritize.
So if the Sunshine Protection Act would pass the Senate and if Wisconsin would move to year-round daylight saving time, what kind of things might need to be changed or adjusted in people's lives to fit the new sunrise and sunset hours?
I think one of the most important things that's going to have to change is that local scoreboards are going to really have to think about what does that time, that uniform time, mean for when they open and close. Do they just follow business practices of like, okay, people are going to expected to be in their office at their desks. Adults are expected to be in their office and their desks at 8:30 or 9 in the morning and set school hours accordingly? Or do they really prioritize student needs and say, you know what, it's going to be dark So let's just figure out what are the hours that school can exist in a way that corresponds to daylight all the time. And then they're going to have to think about athletics and the role of athletics and daycare and all those things around it. So that, to me, that's one of the most important issues that is going to have to be debated over and over again on a local level across Wisconsin and across the United States if this act is turned into law.
Amanda, since I have a historian here, one more thing. Did daylight saving time way back when, during war times, did it actually save any energy?
Yeah, sure, because people used energy differently at the time. It saved electricity and it saved coal because people shifted their sleeping schedules to accommodate the stated hours. And so if they didn't have to be out and about when it was dark, they could stay in bed. They did not have to use electricity. They did not have to use coal or gas in order to stay warm. That was an energy saving measure.
Amanda, thank you so much for this history. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
That was Amanda Seligman, professor of history and urban studies at UW-Milwaukee. We've been exploring the history of daylight saving time and the debates around it. Now, to consider how changing the clocks could affect traffic safety, we turn to David Noyce, professor of transportation engineering and executive associate dean of the College of Engineering at UW-Madison. He starts by talking about the impact on drivers after a clock change.
What we see is that when we spring forward, we tend to see increases in traffic crashes and traffic fatalities. When we fall back, we tend to see reductions in traffic fatalities due to vehicles, but increases in traffic fatalities with pedestrians and bicycles. And the reasons for those are just the change in the lightness and the darkness, primarily in those two different scenarios.
And under the situation, if Wisconsin would move to permanent daylight saving time, there would be some months when the sun wouldn't rise until after 8 in the morning. What impact could that have on our streets and sidewalks during the morning commute in those winter months?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because with the data, there's been a number of studies that's looked at that as well. And what the data shows, it's more about the change than the permanent placement of daylight savings time. And what I mean by that is several studies have looked at if we put daylight savings time into place full year, so we don't switch back and forth, what would happen? And they tend to show that there's an improvement in traffic safety. And again, primarily because you're taking that hour change out of the system. And it's that hour change that seems to be one of the primary drivers in the traffic safety community.
Oh, like we like predictability. And if things don't change, there is that predictable thing that's happening each day. But when a change happens, that might impact traffic or you know, driving, for instance, or being a pedestrian.
Exactly. And what we see in the traffic data is that it's generally that short window, a couple of days to a week after the change, that hour change. You know, so for example, when, you know, we would go from the spring or during spring forward, you know, that hour change tends to be related to more sleep deprivation, you know, the lighting conditions change, your patterns change, you know, just your environment has changed in a way that tends to be detrimental to traffic safety.
Also, if the sun isn't up, you know, icier roads. I'm thinking about how the sun helps kind of melt the roads in the winter a little bit. Can that have an impact?
Yeah, absolutely. So the sun is the key driver here with a lot of this data. And what we also know is that a lot of this changes in traffic safety are related to pedestrians and bicycles. When it's lighter later in the day, that's, you know, on average, that's when more pedestrian and bicycle traffic happens. So when we're lighter later in the day, that the sun provides the visibility, better visibility, the nighttime conditions, and that tends to make the system safer.
What kinds of solutions should communities be thinking about to improve traffic safety in the dark, whether we keep switching the clocks or we implement a permanent daylight saving time?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that nighttime conditions is an issue in traffic safety. If you look at the raw data, you see that fatalities and, you know, significant crashes tend to be 50-50 when you look at daylight and nighttime conditions, but we know that traffic is primarily or about 75% during daylight and 25% during nighttime. So it's not proportional. So what, you know, we try to implement lots of different things in the traffic safety community to improve that. Nighttime conditions, obviously lighting, vehicle lighting is becoming better. We're trying to mark pedestrian crosswalks, mark bicycle paths and facilities. You know, doing anything we can to try and make every road user more visible during those conditions.
David, thank you for these insights. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That was Transportation Engineering Professor David Noyce from UW-Madison. Next, we turn to the health effects of daylight saving time. Dr. Rose Franco is pulmonology and sleep medicine specialist with Froedtert and the Medical College of Wisconsin Regional Health Network. Dr. Franco, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me today.
How does it affect our physical and mental health to spring forward and to fall back every year?
Well, it's a good question. What happens is our brain has to adjust. When we jump forward, it's a lot easier to adjust than when we have to slip back an hour, because our brains are looking for sunrise and looking for sunset and adjusting accordingly. And so we have a lot more trouble, and most people who are on listening to your program would know this, a lot more trouble when we have to fall back than when we have to spring forward.
What are some of the health issues that might come up? What do you see?
Well, the main health issue is one of worrisome sleepiness that can overtake us, and we can have accidents because of that or make mistakes. Otherwise, the main health issues stem from people who may be already affected by how the photoperiod. People with seasonal affective disorder may find that they feel more blue and sad because they have less sunlight exposure because of the lack of sunlight at the end of the day when we have to fall back.
How are sleep patterns and circadian rhythms, you know, our internal body clocks, how are they affected by sunlight?
We have receptors in the back of our eye that track a special wavelength in the blue spectrum that tells our brain that the sun is rising or the sun is setting. Dusk and dawn are the big triggers that tell our brain time to wake up and time to go to sleep. Melatonin is the chemical that is regulating that process. And with the shift in the daylight savings, we have people who are, their brain has to catch up. And we know that when we shift by 1 hour backwards, it takes 3 to 7 days for our brains to catch up if we stick to a schedule of going to bed then an hour earlier.
So we really have to be disciplined there to make that adjustment easier. How would darker mornings affect children and teens?
Well, the biggest concern starts with the start of the school day, because you're getting your children onto the bus when it's darker. And then hopefully, you know, fall comes and it's a little bit lighter in the morning. So there's a safety factor. But more importantly, you know, that first couple of hours in school, the children may be a little less alert that first week because their brain hasn't caught up yet with the new schedule.
Dr. Franco, some studies have pointed to an increase in heart attacks on the Monday following the switch to daylight saving time, and the spring time change may negatively impact heart and brain health. Are you concerned about cardiovascular impacts?
I think those are population-level health effects. When we look at the stress that is put on our bodies when there's a change, you could say that the stress of going to the airport to get on a plane could bring on the same kind of cardiovascular stress as the stress that's brought on by having to make a change in your schedule and then having that whole week to compensate, where you're not probably getting as much sleep as you should. So when we fall back, we end up usually saying we can stay up a little later because we're not sleepy yet. And you end up then robbing yourself of that extra hour of sleep that takes up to a week to compensate for.
So if we stop changing our clocks and just stick to one time, whether it's daylight or standard time, is there something more to consider from a health perspective, or what would happen to our circadian rhythms?
I think we wouldn't have the chaos that is introduced by having the jumping forward and then falling back that we have twice a year. but the downstream effects of having less light in the morning versus more light in the afternoon in the winter months, no one knows for sure unless we look at places where people don't do that. Hawaii, for example, where there isn't any daylight savings, if you will. And I think ultimately things would settle down after the changes made within several months. You would see that it would be addressed as far as the personal health risks. Again, the consequences of making sure that we have safe transitions for people in the morning who are used to having a little bit more light in the winter months is something that has been speculated on, but I'm sure that our society would be able to develop and compensate for that, just like we do now when, at the end of the day when we're going home and we're driving home in the dark.
Dr. Franco, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Rose Franco, pulmonology and sleep medicine specialist with Fradert and the Medical College of Wisconsin Regional Health Network, talking with host Kate Archer-Kent. Earlier, we heard from historian Amanda Seligman at UW-Milwaukee and traffic safety engineer David Noyce from UW-Madison. Been talking about how Wisconsin could be affected by switching to permanent daylight saving time as Congress debates the Sunshine Protection Act. That's legislation that would make daylight saving time happen year-round, no clock changes. And we want to hear what you think of that idea. You've heard a lot of the pros and cons there. What would you think of the idea of daylight saving time all the time? Would you be happy to stop switching your clocks twice a year and the disruption that causes could end? Or do you worry about that, as we were hearing, those late sunrises, especially in the winter? Tell us about it. Share your thoughts. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Coming up, many Wisconsin communities depend on volunteer fire departments for emergency response. A new documentary shares the story of a volunteer department in Door County.
They come from all backgrounds, all types of people, yet they come together to serve the community and the need that it faces.
That's next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Many volunteer fire departments around Wisconsin struggle to recruit and retain members to keep their communities safe. But one Door County Fire Department is going out of its way to honor the history of its volunteers, who often pass on the duty from generation to generation. The Sister Bay and Liberty Grove Fire Department is putting together a history project, along with the local historical society, featuring a new documentary that tells the origins and evolution of the department. In the film, Assistant Fire Chief Billy Apple tells the story of how seeing his dad volunteer inspired him to become a firefighter.
He'd come home from a long day's work, and the pager would go off, and somebody was in need, and to see him jump up, get his shoes on, and boom, he's out the door, and I'd be standing there looking out the front window saying, yeah, that's my dad. He's going to help somebody, and I got so much excitement.
We're learning more about the history of the Sister Bay and Liberty Grove Fire Department and how it shapes the northern Door County community today. Mike Goldstone is the fire chief of the Sister Bay and Liberty Grove Fire Department, and Marianne O'Dowd is director of the History Project and the writer of the new documentary. It's called Through Fire, a Community, the Sister Bay and Liberty Grove Fire Department. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
And Mike, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Mike, I want to hear a little bit about your predecessor as chief of the department. Clearly a big figure in the community and in this documentary. Can you tell us a little bit about Chris Hecht and why you wanted to be part of this project for him in part?
Absolutely. Chris, or Chief Chris Hecht, was an amazing figure. I mean, I'm going to first off by telling you he was a personal friend as well. I worked with him for over 25 years on this department, and to be honest with you, you couldn't meet a better person or a more capable leader. Chief Eck was very innovative. He changed the way and the direction of the department. He added a lot of areas now that we did not do before, community CPR, and I'm sure I know part of the history timeline Marianne has talked about, Chris's role in the COVID and the pandemic. Chris was an outstanding leader, and he was also a big believer in history. He liked to preserve the department's history, and this was something that was very, very near and dear to his heart. And unfortunately, with his illness and then passing, it was very quickly after Chris's illness that I did speak to Marianne, because I knew Marianne had worked so hard on the project previously, and I had said that the department obviously still wanted to go forward and move along with this project. It was a big deal to Chris, and it's a big deal for us and the community.
Marianne, what made this a big deal for you? Why did you want to be part of telling the story of the Sister Bay and Liberty Grove Fire Department?
Well, first, I like a good story, and I knew that there would be a good story here, but a big part of it was really Chris, his passion for this project, his vision. I mean, he had such deep respect for all of the firefighters and chiefs that came before him, and he really felt a personal responsibility to preserve their contributions as well as tell the story of what not only shaped the department, but the entire community.
Mike, before we dig into the history a little bit, can you tell us a little bit about the department today? Many people listening are very familiar with volunteer fire departments. Others, depending on where you live, not at all. Tell us a little bit about your department and how it works.
So our department in many ways is like many other volunteer departments. One of the big differences for us is geography. We are at the tip of a peninsula, which makes for us getting assistance from other fire departments a little more difficult. Most communities live in at least 180 degrees of protection from additional departments, but for everything from us comes from the south. So we can tend to our mutual aid for calls, especially involved calls or technical calls, can be a little bit delayed. But aside from that, we're very much like every other volunteer department. We rely on the volunteerism from the community. Without that, we could not operate. We rely on the support from donations and, of course, from our budget from the taxpayers. So from that side of things, again, very much the same as everybody else. We protect a district of about 52 square miles. And then in that 52 square miles, we have a population that fluctuates. Typically off season, which is anywhere from November through beginning of May, our population around here is about 4,500. During season, because Door County is a tourist destination, our population will swell to above 10,000.
Marianne, let's talk about the origins of the fire department. It was a big fire in Sister Bay that pretty much destroyed Sister Bay. Tell us a little bit about that origin story.
Yeah, and that came about during my initial research and looking at what were some of the milestones that shaped this department. And everything really pointed to that fire of 1912. That was the year that Sister Bay was incorporated, but it was almost the year that Sister Bay disappeared because of this devastating fire. And the community really relied on the goodwill of neighbors grabbing buckets, what they used to call bucket brigades, to try and put out the fire that nearly wiped out the entire community. So that was a real important starting point to tell the department's history. Interestingly, it wasn't until almost 20 years later before they had a department and their first chief. But we use that 1912 fire as the starting point for the story. And it's playing into the premiere of our documentary because we're premiering it on July 31st, which is the anniversary of that fire.
And Mike, since that time, so many people have volunteered with that fire department. You've been there just over a quarter century, I understand. What was it that made you make that decision? Yeah, I want to be part of this community effort. I'm going to join up with this volunteer fire department.
So for me, it was a love of the fire service. I had grown up in England, and I was a career firefighter during my time in the UK. So when I came across over here, I still had that love of firefighting, and Sister Bay Liberty Grove gave me the opportunity to continue that.
You must have been a dream recruit. You had the experience.
No, I can tell you this. There were many people say I was not a dream recruit. Unfortunately, I came in with a lot of opinions and not much political savvy. So Chris, the previous chief, was able to sort of knock me around and get me into the right direction, if you like, where I was able to more subtly approach with my ideas and my previous background. And that's one of the things I'm truly thankful to the previous chief for, is that he was excellent with personnel and management.
We're talking about the volunteer Sister Bay and Liberty Grove Fire Department and a new project documenting its history, including a new documentary. Our guests are documentary writer Marianne O'Dowd and Fire Chief Mike Goldstone. Marianne, a thing that really shines out loud and clear in this documentary and hearing the two of you talk, it's about a fire department, but it's also about a community and a people coming together. Talk a little bit, please, about this as part of a community identity, not just a practical thing that you need there.
Yeah, that's a really good observation, because we're really simply not just recording a department's past. We're preserving a community's memory, a civic identity. And the entire history project is really about generations of neighbors coming together, the responsibility that they took on to protect each other. And oftentimes, a fire department's history, much like in Sister Bay, mirrors the development of a community. So if you just look back over the past, 100 years, Sister Bay grew as its fire department grew.
Mike, as someone who came to Sister Bay from elsewhere, did joining the department make you feel more connected, more part of that community?
Oh, absolutely. There is absolutely no doubt. People have long said that the fire departments are families. They call it the brotherhood, the sisterhood of the fire department. And that is very, very true. And to be honest with you, joining the fire department here allowed me to integrate into the community. Not always an easy one, but it allowed me to integrate into the community far more effectively. And to be honest with you, this community has become the community I've loved the most of all the communities I've lived in. Sister Bay, Liberty Grove are very, very special, and Door County as well.
Marianne, part of your research involved finding older photos and newspaper articles, but there are also oral histories from some of Mike's predecessors with the fire department. What was it like talking to people and sharing their memories of fire departments and technology that's come and gone over the years?
Yeah, the interviews were center to the entire history project, and especially to the documentary film. And it was through those interviews that what became apparent was this was a story about community, not just about fire trucks and fire stations and blazes that were, devastating to the community. It was really about the people and not only what they did, but what it made them feel like, what brought them to the fire department, what made them volunteer. It was interesting that on many occasions, somebody joined the department because they were new to the community and they wanted to get involved and meet other people. Some of the most heartwarming stories and most interesting stories really had to do with what took place after people went on a fire call. It was the camaraderie back at the station when they were unwinding or when they were at a training or some of the social events that took place around the volunteers and the department. So it really became apparent that the common thread throughout this entire history project was that this is a story of a community. It's how people came together to support each other, to build a community, and to really contribute to this identity that is Sister Bay and Liberty Grove.
Mike, I want to talk a little bit about the life of the volunteer firefighter. These are people who are volunteers, who have jobs and lives and families, and you're on call. What does that mean on a practical level for you and your colleagues day to day?
Commitment is basically the word. So for everybody, it's different. There are people that work in the district. There are people that live in the district. Different people have different opportunities to take time away from family and their jobs. And some can give a lot. Some are, struggle to give as much. But that doesn't mean that their commitment is any less. It does take a lot of commitment. You wear the pager. It restricts what you do to a certain extent. And there's a certain factor of when it does activate, you feel that you have a responsibility to respond. And to be honest with you, we kind of rely upon that feeling of responsibility and that commitment to the department. And the people that wear the pager I can't speak highly enough. They come from all backgrounds, all types of people, yet they come together to serve the community and the need that it faces.
Mike, staying with you for a moment, we hear in general a lot of communities in Wisconsin struggling to get volunteers. I've talked to some individual departments who are having a lot of success recruiting people. Where are you in Sister Bay and Liberty Grove?
If I had to be completely honest, I would say we are just holding on. We, again, because of the nature of where we are a peninsula. Typically, our demographic is that the persons that live in the northern part of the peninsula are somewhat older, a fair amount are retired. So we see a different type of people that try to join the fire department. My last two recruits onto the department were both in their 50s, have done remarkably well. And, you know, they are absolutely giving a lot back. But it's we typically see people in the older or middle part of their lives when they join the department. We do have a few young people, but by large, I believe that our median age is above 40.
Marianne, are you hopeful, in addition to telling this community story, that putting some visibility on volunteer fire departments could help maybe lure younger people into giving it a try?
Absolutely. And in fact, Chief Goldstone makes a nice plea at the end of our documentary for anybody who might be interested in joining to contact him. So absolutely. I think it shows the depth of commitment, the training that is provided, everything that goes into being a volunteer firefighter, and the difference that you can make in a community and the connections you can make with other people. So absolutely, I hope people leave thinking that this is something I want to be part of.
Well, Mike, if you don't mind me spoiling the end of the documentary, would you mind making a pitch, especially to our younger listeners, to think about checking out, if they're in a community with a volunteer fire department, checking out serving?
If it's something where you have a little bit of extra time, you feel like you would like to serve your community, then please contact your local fire department's chief or recruitment officer. Typically, there is some training. And I will be honest here, and we don't want to mislead people to think that it's all lights and sirens and fun and games. It's not. But at the same time, the level of brotherhood, we do train together. We become part of a family. We are there typically both formally and socially to support each other. The fire department is my second family, and I'm glad that I'm here. I certainly have no regrets. In fact, it has enhanced my life. Do stop by. Don't assume that your department has enough volunteers. Volunteerism is down, and most fire departments are really looking for help.
And Marianne, the documentary is a big part of your history project here. It's not the only part. What are you working on going forward?
Yeah, we're working on a digital hub or a website, which will essentially be a museum without walls. So we will have the full interviews of all of the people we talked to put together the documentary. We'll have information about all the apparatus that was acquired over the years, important information about all of the milestones that were reached throughout the history of the department, really like a historical repository of the whole department, which will live on a website that hopefully we will be able to focus on now that the documentary is completed.
Marianne, thank you so much for sharing this with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Mike, thanks for being with us.
And thank you very much as well.
Marianne O'Dowd is the director of the Sister Bay and Liberty Grove Fire Department History Project. Mike Goldstone is the fire chief. They're with us today to share their fire department's history and how it reflects the community that it serves, after the release of the new documentary called Through Fire, a Community, the Sister Bay and Liberty Grove Fire Department. Last week on the show, we talked about the Settlement Cookbook, a Milwaukee legend that influences lots and lots of home cooks over the decades, and we invited you to share cookbook projects that have been an important part of your life. Louise and Withy in central Wisconsin texted us with this story. Quote, I wrote a 400-page cookbook I titled Taste of Family Food and Tales. It's a collection of family-tested recipes, their stories, and photos of families across the world with ties to Rosholt Farms of Norway with a dash of humor and ethnic flavor. It has a convenient family tree form and health history. It took 10 years to gather and self-print the project, but worth the effort for family history. Thank you for sharing that with us, Louise. How about you? Is there a family or church or community cookbook project you've been part of? Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text like Louise did. That number is 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Podeswa, Rochelle Wilson, and Lauren Cox. Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful. Learn more at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.